Eldon Taylor, he has been an expert on subliminal communication for years. And he's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here we go. Eldon Taylor, of course, has been researching the power of the mind for the past 25 to 30 years plus, considered to be an expert in the areas of hypnosis, subliminal communication as well, president director of Progressive Awareness Research, and he has developed and patented the inner talk technology, which has been demonstrated by a number of universities, and it's very effective. Eldon, back on Coast to Coast, how are you?
I'm excellent, sir. How are you?
Good. So not only are you a guest on the program tonight, but I was watching Programming the Nation, and there you were again. Good job, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much. But, you know, just before I went, just before I put the headset on and your producer called, I got an email. I have to tell you, it's one of, you know, the fellows that follows me and a very nice person. His name is James. I'll just leave it at James.
Okay.
You know what James said to me?
What did he say?
He said, Eldon, if you'd been given a little more time, you could have got George to run for president. We'd all be a lot more happy.
Well, I'm looking at they have the Fox's presidential debates for the GOP tonight.
Right.
And I'm looking at the results of people voting online who they thought won. Ron Paul crushed everybody.
You know, and that doesn't surprise
me. And he will
me.
Continue to, but he just won't get the national media exposure he needs.
No, he won't. But, you know, at the same time he said that, I heard you and Jeff talking about, you know, the Rats ad. And, you know, I don't want to disagree with Jeff. I love Jeff. But if I understood him correctly, he was basically saying that that ad backfired on the Bush people, and it really didn't. The study that was conducted at Adelphi University used exactly what was done in the Rats ad, and they demonstrated that, indeed, this ad probably influenced the outcome of the election.
Right. As close as it was, it probably helped him, not hurt him.
That's right. And, you know, and I have that right in front of me because just today I put an article at the Huffington Post on exactly that because Ron Paul is the first one that I'm aware of in this new election cycle to get clobbered with a subliminal ad. And in an AMC cable drama, Breaking Bad, there's a subliminal exposure of one of Ron Paul's campaign stickers that depicts him as one of his supporters as being the meth villain in this TV series. So the whole cycle starts again, you know?
Yeah, there's no question about that. No question about that at all. Look, I was asking Jeff, maybe you can help us.
Uh-huh.
What's the legal status with regards to subliminal methods?
You know, the bottom line is there are no laws that prevent someone from utilizing a subliminal message on you at all. The closest we come, Judge Whitehead in the Reno trial, the Judas Priest trial, ruled that it was a invasion, a violation of the First Amendment to expose someone to subliminal messages without informed consent. However, that said, you know, nothing has never materialized as a result of it. As Jeff mentioned, there is an FCC codification that essentially says thou shalt not or we would take your license. But that's aimed at the broadcaster's license, and it requires that the broadcaster knows that they're running a subliminal ad. You know, the Rats ad is, I think, a great picture.
And explain that ad.
Well, you know, this is the famous ad. It goes back to the year 2000 when Al Gore and George Bush were campaigning against one another. And what happened was Bush's people in an ad pulled the words rats, R-A-T-S, out of Democrats and placed that prominently over Gore's head. In a 30-second commercial, they ran heavily in several contested states. And this commercial was all about seniors' access to his proposed,
Social Security, Medicare?
No, yeah, the pills. You know, I can get the pharmacy, I can get the drugs.
Yeah, sure.
Anyway, I'll think of that in a second. Sorry, George, that really bothers me.
Well, they're special prescription programs.
Yeah. Anyway, it was over that. And the Rats ad placed prominently above of Gore's head was detected by the Democratic Party. Now, the long and the short of it goes this way. Not only is it detected, but the Bush people deny it. And, of course, Bush doesn't pronounce it. And a lot of people say that because he couldn't pronounce it, that's how he distanced himself from it. But eventually it was shown that this had to have been done on purpose. And then the Bush people admitted that, yes, it was done on purpose. Okay, the Democratic National Committee, of course, pursued this. They took it as far as they could, which was nowhere. Because the stations that ran the program, ran the ad, had no knowledge that it was there.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Now, the agencies that created the ad that knew it was there, there are no penalties. There are no rules. There's absolutely nothing that you can do to them because it's not against anything for them to do that. So what happened is the ad got withdrawn. Now, in Las Vegas, Nevada, Senator Bob Beers filed a cease and desist order. That's what he had to do in the last election cycle to stop a TV advertisement that used a subliminal image of a gun pointed at a candidate's head. And Beers is a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, and this was the whole issue, you know, right to bear arms.
Right. Well, and look at what Johnson did to Barry Goldwater, but that wasn't subliminal. That was pretty blatant. Remember the nuclear explosion?
That's right, I do. I sure do. That's probably the most famous ad that ever appeared in, you know, the realm of politics. It destroyed Barry Goldwater completely. He was all in favor of limited nuclear weapons. But when you say that, we really get into a shaded area here of what is subliminal. If you look at if we want to be technical and we want to say it's not available to conscious awareness because of some detection flaw in our perceptual ability. For example, we're flashing it at 1/50th of a second. We simply cannot see that. We can't distinguish it. We have a limitation, a physical limitation that blocks that. That's one definition. But if we think of it in the broader sense of information that is not being attended to by critical consciousness, is bypassing critical awareness, is entering our mind without attention, then we've got a much broader definition. And there we suddenly open up to why we have product placement in ads, why Apple's logo is so much stronger with regard to creativity than IBM's.
Right.
And you know, researchers, and you guys touched on that a little in the last hour, but the neuromarketers, you know, they get really sophisticated. They use functional magnetic resonance imaging to look at the brain live. And when they're looking at the brain live, they can see how we respond to everything. And they begin to collect all this information. We in the last few years, learned lots of things that, you know, you kind of put together. Like, for example, negative subliminals work better than positive. So,
and what do you mean by negative? Like rats, that kind of thing?
Like rats, the words. You know, it can be anger, it can be hostile.
I hate you, I hate you, stuff like that.
Yeah, an angry face has a stronger reaction than a smiling
face. Okay, so but how would you use the negative subliminal ad to your benefit?
Well, you can use a negative subliminal to sell a product simply because you're creating an anxiety. One of the things that Jeff mentioned, but I wasn't sure that it was really covered in depth, is that the scheme of neuromarketing, the scheme of our modern marketers, whether they're selling you a politician or they're selling you, a product, the scheme is to create a need. It's kind of goes like this. I'm not going to buy a life jacket unless I'm convinced I'm going to drown.
Right.
You know, I don't buy flood insurance unless, you know, I think there might be a flood. So what I have to do is create a need. And the best way to create the need is to create anxiety. You had a caller in the last hour that he mentioned identifying an anxiety he was having as a result of becoming aware of the subliminal observers are here. Well, let me tell you something. Philip Zimbardo, past president of the American Psychological Association, stated in his work, The Lucifer Effect, that we have found that pathological symptoms develop in up to one-third of normal participants in the rational process that they're trying to make sense of unexplained sources of arousal. So when you have this anxiety, you have this arousal, you have this paranoia, you're not certain why, you're not sure where it's coming from. One-third of the public that has those feelings is going to develop pathological symptoms. When you look at our society, you look at the violence, you look at the consumption, you look at the instability, you look at the lack of civility, period. To me, it's all of this correlates to precisely what we're talking about today.
What is it about the brain that accepts these subliminal messages?
Well, you know, the brain attends to everything. I can tell you from years past using forensic hypnosis that, well, I'll just give you an exact case that comes to my mind. I was called to a police station one morning, maybe I'd be about 2 a.m. in the morning. A victim had just been through an armed robbery. He worked for a theater. He left the theater with a night deposit, pulled up to the after-hours night deposit at the bank. And all of a sudden, you know, there's a guy with a big gun sticking in his face, taking the money. And the only thing he can tell us is it was a very big gun.
Yeah.
It was a very big gun. That's all he can tell us.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, under hypnosis, this young man had worked for a Hertz automobile agency for a few years before going to work for this theater chain. And under hypnosis, he had seen the car pull in behind him in his rearview mirror. And just that flash, just that quick instant, we might even think of as peripheral vision.
Mm-hmm.
But because of his experience at Hertz, he was able to tell us the make and the year of his automobile.
Okay.
Okay? He saw the driver in the car because the passenger door opened and the dome light was on. He was able to give us a partial on that. He was able to tell us about the fingernails and the grease that was under them and on the knuckle lines, indicating that the perp was maybe a mechanic.
Maybe.
An automobile
okay.
Mechanic.
Or a manual laborer or something.
Right. And he was, well, this was automobile grease he was defining, but yeah. At any rate, and he was also able to tell us the caliber of the weapon. Now, before I went to bed that morning, before dawn came, we had the perps and we'd recovered the money. And all on the basis of what he was able to tell us in the state of hypnosis.
That is amazing. So I assume the cops, what they do is they'll feed all this into a computer, right?
Right.
And out spits about a few possibilities, a few suspects. Matching cars, things like that, and there he is.
That's right. That's right. In this instance, it happened to be even easier than that because we had a detective that was able to say, hey, I think I know who that is.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, but, yeah, that's exactly what they would do. But my point is this. Here you are in this very quick moment of an armed robbery. And for all intent and purposes, this entire thing maybe takes less than a minute. You know, the gun's in your face, you've handed off the money, the guy has run away, and you're trembling and you're shaking, and, you know, maybe you've even urinated your pants. And in that short frame of time, the only thing you've noticed, the only thing you're conscious of is that was a very big gun that scared the water right out of me, right? But when we change that role of the mind and we back away from it and we look at it, all of a sudden, we can take that 30 seconds of time and we can stretch it out. And we get all this fine detail out of it. It's even greater detail than you would get one frame at a time, as you were discussing in the last hour, looking at a film. And that's how the mind works. It has the ability to take all this information simultaneously. Now, while it's handling this information, it has a budget. The budget has to do with attention. Obviously, it can't bring to your attention everything that it's processing, from your heartbeat and the blood flow in your toe to, you know, the conversations, the wind in the background or whatever else.
Well, see, I have a theory. Let me ask you this, Eldon, first.
Sure.
If you look at a crowd of 100 people, just one glance, my theory is you'll be able to remember a couple of them describe who they are, and that's about it. But under maybe hypnosis or something, I think the brain is like a camera, and it records everything it sees, and in your head somewhere, subconsciously or otherwise, you have recognized and identified everyone in that crowd, everyone in that 100 crowd picture that you have, and then something can bring it out, whether it's hypnosis, I don't know what. But is the brain capable of that?
You know, that would make a very interesting study. I would really like to run that one. You've given me a new challenge. My answer is going to be a calculated answer. I can't say on the basis of some solid research. We know that there are limitations in conscious memory. That's why
conscious memory.
Yeah, that's why 7 is how many digits there are in our phone system, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to what you just suggested, my hunch would be you are right. But there isn't. I can't turn to a study, and I can't say with any certainty that indeed is true. My personal experience would say that is correct, because utilizing forensic hypnosis as I did for years, the amount of information we were able to get out of an individual in hypnosis in circumstances where we didn't think we had anything at all was incredible. You know, one of the problems that you have in investigations is you're gonna have 3 witnesses to an armed robbery, and they'll give you 3 different descriptions. One will tell you it was a black guy 6 foot tall, and somebody will tell you, oh no, it was a Puerto Rican 5 foot tall, and somebody else will say, no, he was 5 foot across and he was a honky.
Or a white guy.
And well, that's what I mean by honky.
Oh, see, I'm behind the times.
No, well, I don't know about that. But at any rate, you know, the bottom line is, from 3 people, you get 3 entirely different descriptions that they saw the same thing. But when we put them under hypnosis, we had consistency in what they saw. And there was a great value to its use as an investigative tool. So I do suspect that you are probably right.
I think so. And did you know that most media now, television, specifically radio and also newspapers, in terms of descriptions of a suspect, will not mention race anymore unless it's specific to the identification of the suspect. That they won't do it anymore, and that's how times have changed.
Yeah, and that's not a bad idea.
I agree.
One of the things that I see all the time, when you talk about hypnosis, is somebody will use hypnosis, say, for past life regression. And obviously there's an implicit assumption the minute you say, well, let's do some past life regression hypnosis. And that assumption is there is such a thing as a past life. And then in doing that, they'll say, okay, now I want you to go to your first life. And I want you to notice what, the surroundings around you, the kind of furniture, da-da-da-da-da. And when they say something like the kind of furniture, they have just suggested to you what it is that you're going to see. Now, in law enforcement, in utilization of forensic hypnosis, the first thing that you're taught is you never, never give any information of that kind. So you would not say, was he, white, was he Hispanic, You have to ask them in a rather, what is it that you see? Would you describe that for me?
Right.
Can you give me more detail?
Was there a dent on the car?
Yeah,
and
well,
things like that.
If they say, there's a car, then you might ask that. But you wouldn't say, what was the getaway car? What color was the getaway car?
Unless they
told you.
Without
them telling you that there was a getaway car.
Okay, you don't,
they went away in a truck.
You don't want to lead them.
That's right. And that becomes critical. One of the things that we know about hypnosis is, and memory, it is a great confabulator. In fact, one of the recent studies...
Hold on, Elton. We're already at the bottom of the hour. We're coming right back as we go toward the top of the hour. Stay with us, Eldon Taylor on Coast to Coast AM. And you're listening to Eldon Taylor on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll take phone calls with him next hour as we talk about mind programming on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Eldon Taylor. Of course, we'll take your calls next hour. With the subliminal programming, is it good or is it bad?
You know, George, it is a double-edged sword. You know, the bottom line is there's a lot of research that shows the power of utilizing subliminal to prime self-talk in ways that can accelerate learning abilities, can assuage anxiety, can lower tension, hostility, and aggression. In fact, I got into the field because I was exploring this technology in a lie detection practice. I wanted to design a tool that would cause people that came into my offices to tell the truth and or to have such, you know, reactions, strong reactions, that there would be no such thing as an inconclusive. We would easily be able to say there was a practice of deception. And it was a friend of mine at the Utah State Prison who said to me, Eldon, this is working so well for you in this environment. Do you think it would assist in lowering hostility and aggression in the prison? And we went out to the prison. We ran a very tight double-blind study. And the fact of the matter was we were able to lower hostility and aggression. I've been able to use technology, subliminal technology, in school systems with incarcerated juveniles who are court-ordered to complete an education sufficient to pass a GED, to work with Fortune 500 executives, elite athletes, and I've seen the benefits that can be had by using subliminal in a positive way. Right. That said, you know, one of the great services you're doing that Jeff did with the film is bringing attention to the fact that more and more it's being used in pernicious ways and in every possible environment. We're seeing it. Indeed, there was an article that I looked at just not less than a week ago in the United Kingdom, a team of marketeers who have created a grocery store that utilizes nothing but subliminal everything. They have subliminal messages. They have special scents and smells.
And you know that going in, right?
Yeah, you know that going in. And in fact, they tease you telling you about that going in. You know, I can remember being involved, when you say going in, being involved in legislation way back in the mid-'80s that we attempted to get through in the state of Utah. And, you know, all this legislation would be is informed consent, like the microwave oven stickers that the restaurants used to put on their windows that said, we have a microwave, when everybody was afraid microwave might do something to you.
Right.
Okay. Well, you if you entered a store that used subliminal messages, there would be some sticker, some decal. It would just say, you know, we use subliminal messages. And perhaps maybe you would have access to see what those messages were because, you know, buy now could be argued to be a, you know, theft prevention message, but it's also definitely a motivational message, isn't it?
Good point.
Yeah. So at any rate, you know, this looked like this would be really easy to do. We'd get this passed. It'd be the first state to get it. They'd had these hearings in 84 at a congressional level. There was a lot of hoopla about it all. But I tell you, George, before it got out of committee, when it was time for the committee to vote, that last day, the veritable who's who of the advertising world from around the country arrived. And they all had the same thing to say. We don't use it. And I'll tell you why we don't use it. It doesn't work. And so there's nothing, no reason for you to write these laws. There's nothing for you to be afraid of. The amount of pressure that was placed, although we were able to get this passed in the committee, never came to the floor for a vote. So to this day, you know, there still are no laws anywhere. Mm-hmm. By the way, what I was searching for in my statin moment was the prescription drug benefit for seniors that was attached to Medicaid that Bush campaigned as one of his promises.
Was the color scheme that Homeland Security set up after 9/11, which I hated, was that a form of subliminal programming?
In that broader sense that we defined it, the answer, in my view, is absolutely yes. I mean, anything that is designed to heighten awareness that becomes a symbol a visual image that we associate, like logos. I mentioned the logo, the Apple logo. Actual research shows us that because of the pairing of that Apple logo with
the bite out of it.
Yeah, with the creativity that has gone on with Apple in all of the Apple products in its early use in schools, you feel more creative with an Apple computer than you do with an IBM, and that's exactly how you report it. These logos have power. These images have power. And color itself has a power. You know, one of the things that that I used to do when I was conducting lie detection tests, and this isn't kind of fair, but it's worth sharing with you. We used to use what's called the Lusher color test.
Well, and remember the book Dress for Success,
yeah,
which we'll talk about in a moment. Go ahead.
Yeah. But I had this book, the Lusher color test, and I had a paperback version of it, mass market. It sat on my desk. And in the pre-exam, I would ask somebody, because I was looking for a situational stress that I could create, I would ask them, what's your favorite color? And they would give me a favorite color, whatever it was. It didn't matter, you know. And I would say to them, do you know what that means? I mean, have you told your significant other? I mean, do they know what it? I mean, and I would do this for two or three. I'd pick the book up and say, color is the easiest thing in the world to stress someone on. And by the time I was through, I would have a question that I would ask in my examination. Tell me the truth. Is your favorite color blue? I would always have stress on that because I would have pre-stressed that color. And this is something that you can do. Now, the bottom line is this: the Lusher color test tells us that there are different colors that are associated with mood states. And, you know, depending on the color that I tend to identify with, let's take red. Red is a universal color in all cultures of danger, of fire, of alert, of energy.
Of love?
No, not of love.
Well, hearts.
Yeah,
Valentine's Day, everything's red.
Yeah, I know that. But that's passion. That's the emotion, passion.
Huh.
You know,
Chinese restaurants, red, because they want you to eat.
Well, they're orange and red. Orange is the eating color. But you're right. You're on to it. You've got it, you know. These colors relate to schemas that are associated in our minds with feelings. And so when they had the color coded, and if you looked at those colors, when they had the color coded elevation of danger, they became symbols, and the colors themselves had psychological meanings. And we didn't see that these colors, you know, we didn't have pastel blue or soft pink. We had the hard colors that would be indicative of our natural response to becoming anxious or afraid or thinking of danger or becoming prepared. I mean, anxiety in modern man is really just fight flight. And it's the state where we're prepared to either fight or flee. If you think about how that's created, how that's generated, we're in this state of heightened arousal that maintains in suspense. Well, not only is that disquieting and troublesome, but it's also something we seek to be rid of. So if somebody can come along and solve that for us, come along and give us an answer to it, we're quick to take it.
I used to read so many studies on color, Eldon, you're going to get a kick out of this, that when I was a news director in St. Louis for a television station, uh-huh, I would pick the color of the clothes I wanted my anchor people to wear. And let me tell you why. When I came in there and their ratings were kind of floundering, we had a sports guy who would wear a plaid outfit, and I had another anchor man who would wear green and all that. And all the studies that I would study and read showed that certain colors equated with certain kinds of power and image.
Right.
And you know, I changed them immediately to solids, black, this, that, got rid of the plaids, got rid of the green, other than St. Patty's Day.
Right.
And I got to tell you, the ratings went up dramatically, because of the clothes, but people had different perceptions of people. If a guy goes into a bank meeting or a board meeting and he's wearing a plaid outfit, and another guy comes in and he's wearing a nice tie and a black suit, he's going to get more attention. I guarantee it.
He has the power.
He's got
the
power.
No question about that. If you mentioned Dress for Success, I'm sure. I mean, there's two things that happen when you say that, George. One of them is what you just indicated. The audience, your station's audience, is going to respond to your station differently. The level of professionalism, the level of sobriety, the level of, intellectual gravitas is going to be greater because of the solids, the blacks, the ties than it is in the plaids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? All right, no question about that. But the other thing is, when you dress that way, you change. You know, we all know, look, if you've got your jeans and your tennis shoes on, you walk differently, you feel differently.
And you're comfortable.
Yeah. You're just hanging out with your buddies. You're going fishing or something. It isn't just your dress that changes. The way you walk changes. Your vocabulary will change.
Absolutely.
You'll slump some. Your posture will change. Take the same person, put them in that three-piece suit, tie, and they're much more erect.
Well, and I got to tell you, my weekend, let's use Los Angeles as an example.
Okay.
You know, it's generally casual on weekends most of the time. But, you know, every once in a while, I will wear a jacket, a suit without a tie, open shirt.
Mm-hmm.
On many of those weekends, my days off, I'll wear a T-shirt and jeans and, my shoes, my black shoes and stuff like that. And I feel more comfortable like that because when I'm in the suit, I feel like I have to be on all the time. And that's, I don't know why, but I feel like things are a little more deliberate. But if you're sitting around in a T-shirt and jeans and having a glass of wine, it's more relaxing. Why do I feel that way?
Well, I think that's just natural. I mean, you know, the bottom line goes like this, and I had this conversation with a friend of mine who is a psychologist who rides a Harley and who has a radio show. And, in her office as a clinician, there is one person. And the way she dresses, the pantsuits, et cetera, that's entirely different than when she puts her chaps on to get on that Harley. And the way she talks is entirely different. And, when she does her radio show, there she's more casual. She's somewhere in between those two. But we have three different personalities in this person, given what she is doing. And with that, three different attires. You know, I live in Washington State, and I've got a little horse ranch. And I can tell you that because of this training, because of all the years I've spent paying attention to how the mind responds to everything, I watch myself all the time. But if I put my boots and chaps on, I become very aware that I am a different person. And I mean this from the inside out. I am a different person at that moment than I am in a suit and tie on a university campus giving a lecture.
Yep.
I'm just a different person. So, the bottom line is what we have done is accepted images in our mind. These images, for all intent and purposes, have been programmed there. A cowboy walks this way, talks this way, looks this way. You know, a motorcycle rider, a doctor on a university campus, and the bottom line is who we really are is likely to be more like where you are. I know for myself, give me the beach, Levi's, mm-hmm. fishing rod, a glass of wine, hey, I'm one happy camper. But in that role, I'm also not comfortable being the other things that people see me to be.
So if someone came up to Eldon Taylor, the author, the expert, the psychologist of events, and you were in your jeans, you wouldn't feel comfortable with that, would you?
No, you're right. I wouldn't. I would be uncomfortable there.
You'd rather be in a suit if they're going to approach you on that kind of level.
Yeah, what happens is if you're an expert, and just think about this for a minute. Let's assume that you're going into a court of law and you're going to give testimony and you are the expert. You're going to sit up on the stand, and maybe the testimony you're going to give is going to make the difference, life and death.
Sure.
I'm thinking of a case that I actually testified in where a young man had been convicted of the homicide of his mother in a very brutal way, and he was innocent. And my testimony was the turning point that got him out of prison. He was in prison.
Wow.
We had to earn a new trial, throw out all that. So, imagine that you're going in there and you know how important this testimony is. Okay, am I going to go in there in my jeans and my tennis shoes, my shirt untucked, sit down, cross my legs on that witness stand and say, what's happening, guys? No.
Hey, jury, believe me.
Yeah, the world operates because we have these expectations. If you remember when President Obama took office, he was going to do away with ties. That lasted one day.
Yeah.
One day.
Yep.
The fact of the matter is the roles that we play, it isn't just how we feel, it's how that individual that we're talking to responds to us. See, if I'm talking to a jury in that casual, I'm not as credible as I am as Dr. Taylor in that suit.
John Kennedy was one of the best for this, Eldon, because he knew the image he wanted to portray. He was either in a suit when it came to the Cuban Missile Crisis or whatever, but then when he wanted to give people the illusion that he was out having fun, relaxing, he'd have a white shirt rolled up, he'd be wearing his pants, loafers, walking on the beach, and, he gave that illusion, he gave that image, he understood.
I agree. I think, another one would be Ronald Reagan.
Right.
Two of them knew exactly how to be appropriate for whatever the message was that they were delivering.
You dress for the moment. Sometimes, yeah. For example, a guy in a suit and tie comes across as unapproachable, but the same guy in a suit with an open collared shirt, hey, he's pretty cool.
Yeah, could be. That's right. But again, it comes back to the role. If the person that's approaching me is coming up to talk to me about my own radio show, hey, that's different. But if they're coming up to talk to me about, I've got this anxiety and I don't know what's causing it and it's really spilling out in my family and I have this hostility and I've had these aberrant thoughts about maybe slapping the shit out of somebody, I don't want to be talking to them in a casual way.
No, you don't want to do that. By the way, yeah, you got to watch what you say.
Yes, sir.
On my show, okay?
Yes, sir.
Only because that throws off my whole system.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I had to hit the delay button on that. And anyways, just remember that.
All right, George, I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay. That happens to people,
It does.
It's real life, isn't it?
It is. It is real life.
All right, let's get into the color scheme of subliminal. Do experts understand that? Do they know that?
Well, the answer to that's absolutely. I mean, that knowledge has been, that's old knowledge. That's knowledge from the 40s and the 50s. And, of course, a lot of that has been, restudied and verified. But when it's all said and done, nothing has really changed. What we do have is a whole new era of understanding. You and Jeff mentioned television as a case in point. We know that people sit down in front of the television set, and we know that they seem to go into some altered state. I mean, people often sit in front of the TV, and you can holler, "Hey, George," and you have to go shake them to get their attention. What we have learned utilizing some of the latest technology. I mean, in the 50s. The 60s, actually, it was late 60s, I think 68, 69, using polygraph.
Now, hold on. Let's come back and talk about that, and we'll take a final hour of phone calls with you, Eldon, when we come right back on Coast to Coast.